A. M. Amazing. I am 62.
My oldest daughter died on my birthday last year at age 62.
Oh,
she
wow.
She had cancer.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah. Were are we going, Mikey?
Yeah.
Were you be O born?
Oh, where was I born?
A T R O troublemaker. Were you born a troublemaker?
Probably not, but what happened to me in my childhood made me a troublemaker. I was born in Iowa on a farm, in a farmhouse.
Wow. Why? How? Did you become a troublemaker?
Well, it's a little bit of a story. My parents were very abusive. And, of course, I don't remember it, but my mother and my grandmother told me that my father beat me up for the first time when I was 2 months old. And he continued to abuse me and my three siblings and my mother. I finally got away from it when I went to college at age 16. But my parents were active members of the American Legion because my father was in World War I. So I was brought up in the Legion. And in those days, the Legionnaires said, our sons will never have to go to war because we fought the war to end all wars. And my father's abuse was blamed on his being what then they called shell shock, now they call it post-traumatic syndrome, and gassed in the war. After I grew up, I talked to my aunts, and they said, well, that might have had something to do with it, but our father, whom I remember as a frail old grandfather, beat us up, and he was abused, he and his siblings, by his father. As you probably know, family violence gets passed down. So I really learned about love not from my parents at all, but from my father's stepmother, who was one of the most loving women I'd ever known, and then from a black lady who, when we moved to Chicago, used to come and help take care of us when my mother had TB and was in the hospital a couple of times. And then I had a wonderful Sunday school teacher in the Methodist Church who said, always told us, don't ever look down on anybody because their skin is a different color, or they wear raggedy clothes, or they talk different than you. Jesus loves each one of us just as we are. So those are the people that I learned about love from. Then when I went to Northwestern University and I joined the First Methodist Church there, the minister was a Dr. Ernest Fremont Tittle, and he was one of the social gospel theologians of the 20s, 30s, 40s, Rauschenbusch was the best known of them, but Dr. Tittle wrote many books. And there was a large young people's fellowship in the church. And Dr. Tittle was very conscious of what was going on. He had close connections to Quakers, and they knew what was going on in Germany, even if nobody else in this country, because the Quakers fed the Germans and the French after World War I, and then again after World War II, when they were starving. So the Quakers actually tried to talk to Hitler to change his what he was doing, but they were not successful. But Dr. Tittle was an ardent pacifist and believed in nonviolence. And so that was what we learned. And of our whole large group in the Young People's Fellowship, about half were women and a half were men, and over half of the men became conscientious objectors in World War II. But as a result of my upbringing, both in the Legion and the Methodist Church, I connected, especially when they talked about my father and his injuries, I connected the violence of war with family violence. And when I found nonviolence through Dr. Tittle and through hearing people speak like A.J. Musty and Norman Thomas, I felt like I was home. That was where I belonged. I wanted never to be violent and to pass that on. And so that's how I got to be a troublemaker, because nonviolence is not inaction or non-action. Nonviolence is very active action.
Yes. Yes.
And so that's the answer to your question, Frank.
And you, G-O, got in to the L-A. B. O. Labor. M. O.
Movement.
Movement. Mm-hmm.
Well, that was one thing I did, yes. I first I got involved in anti-war work, and I was one of the very first members of CORE, Committee of Racial Equality and Nationally, the Congress of Racial Equality in Chicago in the early 40s, where we were sitting in at restaurants, and one of the most famous ones was the White City Roller Rink, which I didn't participate in because I no longer was a roller skater. But in Evanston, we worked on barbershops and restaurants. And CORE went on to conduct the very first rides on buses through the South in 1947. Right after the Irene Morgan decision in the Supreme Court in 1946, that interstate travel could not be segregated. So CORE devised this, what later became the Freedom Rides. And we women, of course, wanted to participate, but it was decided wisely that combining white and black men and then putting white and black women into the the situation was not smart. So the men got to go. There wasn't enough women money for two projects, so the men got to do it. Some of your listeners may remember the names like Bayard Rustin and Jim Farmer, and George Hauser, all were participants in that journey of reconciliation. Went into the Upper South as far as North Carolina. They didn't go into the Deep South like the later Freedom Rides. And some of them got arrested and put on chain gangs, but in general, they opened up the interstate transportation to unsegregated situations. And not only on the buses themselves, but in the bus stations and in the bus restaurants. So that was one of the things I did later on when I went to Washington. I worked in a department store for a while, and then I met an organizer who was starting to organize the very first interracial white-collar union in Washington. That was during World War II, and nobody was allowed to go on out on strike, of course, except the UAW. They got away with it, but they were so much bigger. So we picketed and leafleted and talked. I had worked in this store, so I knew people. And I took a leave of absence to go do a demonstration. When I came back, I decided I was going to stay out and help with the organizing. So for months, we leafleted, we picketed, we had our meetings in a great big anonymous office building downtown because the employees were so frightened to be seen or, you know, going to a meeting. Some women had worked there as sales clerks for 30 years, and they were getting $18 a month. What we had for a lunch room was a little closet with a counter, and we had to stand up to eat our lunch in 15 minutes, those in the, when we worked in the store. We organized across the whole staff, except management, the stock clerks, the janitors, as well as the sales clerks in the office. It was an AFL union. At that time, AFL and CIO weren't combined, but my organizer organized CIO style, everybody. So eventually we got enough signed cards to have an election. And we got all but 5 votes in that store of the people eligible to vote. Then we had the job of getting a contract, and that was not easy. But we finally did. And then we went on and we organized the other stores, department stores in Washington, except Woodward and Lothrop. The people who worked there, they felt they were sort of the cream of the crop. So after a while, we didn't bother with them because the workers in our stores got better wages than Woodward and Lothrop. So if they didn't want to join in, that was it. So that was my labor organizing adventure. It was during World War II. And also during World War II, after that, I was sort of by default put in charge of what was called the National Committee on Conscientious Objectors, NCCO. NCCO dealt with conscientious objectors in prison and in the military. And there was another organization called the National Service Board for Religious Objectors that worked with the men who were in alternative service. So when I think about it, you know, here I was, a woman of 23, 24, going on 24, heading up a national organization in Washington in that day and age when almost no women did anything like that. It was, again, default because the men were all in prison or alternative service. So,
yes.
So I worked with the Bureau of Prisons, the head of the Bureau of Prisons, Mr. Bennett, who famously said at the end of the war, get those GDCOs out of my prisons, because COs in prisons were forever going on hunger strikes or work strikes or demonstrations. They did away with segregation, racial segregation, many of the prisons.
P.
They liberalized the...
Pains in the asses. They're pains in the asses.
Right. Right. And there's a funny story. My husband, whom I met because I helped him, like lots of others, to get parole. I also worked with the U.S. Parole Board. And he was in Ashland, Kentucky at the federal prison. And they had a baseball team, and a lot of local teams would come into the prison to play games. And there was a big, important game coming up, and all the COs were in the hole, as they said, in segregation, because they were on some kind of strike, work strike or something. And so... all the prisoners and some of the guards went and asked the warden if he wouldn't let them out of the hole to play that game, because it was a very important game in the tournament. So he did. He was not a bad warden, the one at Ashland. He was pretty reasonable as the wardens went. And they won the game. The man whom I later married was the pitcher. So there's all kinds of stories about what the COs did to change the prisons. One of the things that happened was that previously nobody in federal prison could apply for parole until 3/4 of the sentence was over. And the COs agitated and agitated. They got that down to a third of the sentence.
Wow.
They did away with segregation. They just refused to obey segregated rules, whether they were prison rules or the rules of the prisoners. And, of course, once the war was over and they left, prisons tended to go back to their patterns. So when the Korean War came along, the COs had to do it all over again. But that's the way things go. I also worked with the military because there were men in the military who became conscientious objectors, and they could apply either to do non-combatant work in the medical corps or the chaplaincy corps, something like that. Or they could, if their conscience wouldn't let them stay in the military at all, they could apply for a discharge. And so I worked with a lot of commanding officers and chaplains and what are called JAG, a judge advocate general. Those are the lawyers in the military. And I found that a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them were very fair, decent people. And I'll never forget, this was long after World War II, because I continued my counseling of conscientious objectors for many years. I walked into a JAG officer's office one day at the Newport, Rhode Island base to talk to him about a conscientious objector who needed to be released. I open the door, I walk in, and here's a great big picture of Gandhi and a great big picture of Martin Luther King up on his wall above his desk.
Wow.
I looked a little startled, and he said, "What's the matter?" And I said, "I didn't expect to see those particular pictures in a military office." And he said, "Those are the people that we should be following."
Wow.
He never explained it to me, but I didn't know that a lot of doctors and lawyers who had government scholarships to go through their professional schools, they often had to work off those scholarships by going in the military or going to Indian reservations or going to federal prisons. So maybe he was one of those. I didn't ask him. Yeah. He did get a discharge for my client. Anyhow, that was a very enlightening experience for me to work with top officials. And a funny story that happened later on, I went to prison myself, to federal prison, for a protest at the second
K U I N V A invaded A B A S a base. You invaded a base?
Yes, I walked into the second ICBM base. It was a project we had. The base was, the ICBM is Intercontinental Ballistic Missile, and it was the second one constructed in this country. And it was near the beginning of the nuclear arms race in 1959. And a lot of us climbed a fence or walked into the base. It was a summer-long protest. And I ended up in federal prison at Alderson, West Virginia. It's a women's federal prison. And
I, B, R, B, E, Bet, U, were a P A I pain in the ass.
Yes. Yeah. Right. I've always been a pain in the ass.
Me too.
Okay. We're like minded here. But one day, the same director of the federal prison system, Mr. Bennett, came to visit Alderson. And if we wanted to, we could sign up to have an interview with him. So when I walked in the room, his mouth dropped open and he said, "What are you doing here?" I don't think he ever expected to see me in one of his prisons.
Not S, not A, as A, J, A, I, L, jail, B, I,
R, D,
bird, not as a jailbird.
Well, he didn't expect to see me, but I've been to jail many times, and that was the only time in federal prison. But I don't know how many times I've been arrested. And sometimes those were rather humorous situations. I got arrested once with my son Scott when he was about 3 years old in Hartford. We were protesting the air raid drills where you were supposed to run and hide. And So we were all standing out on the street, and they arrested us, and they arrested Scotty along with me. And he was quite a cute little kid, so while they had me locked up in the cell, all the secretaries in the jail office were having fun playing with him. I think we, for some reason, they dismissed those cases. I never had to serve a sentence on that one. But
in the in the 60s, I.W.E.
went
into the Marine Recruiting Office.
Into where?
Frank went into the Marine Recruiting Office. And T.R. tried to enlist.
Oh, you tried to enlist.
He wanted to enlist.
They wouldn't enlist you?
Well, no. They said, what could you do? They said, what could you do?
Uh-huh.
You, in, they, S-A, they said I was T. I was T. Not. I was not C. F. U. F. I. Fit.
You were not fit. Yeah.
But I kept saying I want to join in. No, I want to join. They did not know what to do with you?
Well, they probably knew you'd be a pain in the ass and a troublemaker.
Yes. They. That. There. Then. I said I could pee. I could push the button.
Oh.
That's when they kicked you out, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, Code Pink is over at the Berkeley recruiting station every day.
Yes.
What a wonderful job they do over there.
Yes.
I think they raise consciousness. The trouble is, in Berkeley, consciousness is pretty well raised. They need to do it elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But there are, again, developed like in the Vietnam War, coffee houses in towns where there are bases. There's the courage to resist group which supports conscientious objectors in the military, helps them to get discharges. And you know that the Canadian Parliament has voted to accept U.S. soldiers who are AWOL or who do not want to go back to Iraq or Afghanistan. But Prime Minister Harper will not, concur with that vote. So he's shipping people back. He's kicking out people, some of who've been there for several years with their families, and they're being court-martialed. And So our Canadian friends are hoping to get a new prime minister next year.
That we have C-O-M. be covered, that on lover. Well, Jen lived in Toronto for until like a year ago, and so she would videotape a lot of those events and then mail us the tapes, and we would play them on Lover.
Yeah. Well, the Canadians were wonderful during the Vietnam War, and when I have written them recently, I've thanked them for that and for the vote in Parliament. But let's hope. I don't know. I wish that Obama would, go down the right path on this, both Afghanistan and Iraq.
I don't think. Yes, I don't think so.
Well, it doesn't look like it, and yet I'm just reading his second book, and he comments in that book about how the Bush administration raised the defense budget by 74% during his administration. And so I'm in the middle of writing President Obama a letter. He probably will never read it, but maybe somebody will. Yeah. And saying, if you just cut the military budget 50%, it would still be higher than it was when Clinton was in. And think what we could do with that money.
Mm-hmm.
We could do all these things that need to be done.
Did you? No. I ran for president?
Did you?
Yeah.
Wow, if you run again, I'll vote for you. I've been one of the things I've done, I've been a war tax resister. Since 1949, I have refused to file a return, and I have refused to pay income taxes. And instead, when I was working, and my husband and I together gave away a third of our income to organizations and just to individuals who were in need. Now I'm not working and my income is very low, so I just tithe. I can't give away a third of it. Mm-hmm. But I have always been open about it. I'm talking to you about it on radio.
Right.
That's just one way in which women can...
And you've never been approached or nothing?
Well,
happened?
I have some funny stories about that, yes. I have been a couple of times.
Do we want to hear that? Yes.
Well, one time when we lived in Pennsylvania, IRS was investigating us. This was in the 50s. And we lived in an interracial community, and my husband was helping to build deliberately interracial housing in Pennsylvania, in Bucks County, and then in Princeton, New Jersey. And so an IRS man came to talk to me about our tax problem, as he called it. And this IRS man had moved here from Ireland, and he told me he had been in the IRA when he was in Ireland, but now he was working for the U.S. government.
Wow.
So he came, would sit and talk for a couple of hours, and I would give him coffee. And he would see my kids and all these other kids, white, black, Asian, running in and out of the house and playing in the yard. This went on for several months, and he finally came one day and he said, well, I'll tell you what I've decided. I've decided that you and your husband don't really owe any taxes because of all your children. Now he knew they weren't all my children.
Wow.
One day he said to me, I was explaining what pacifism was and nonviolence. And he had a sort of surprised look on his face, and he said in that Irish brogue of his, "Well, Mrs. Swan, you know what? If everybody believed that way, we wouldn't have any war, would we?" I said, "Bingo, you got it."
Exactly.
And then another time, my husband and I were two of the main organizers of the New England Committee for Nonviolent Action, which existed for 35 years, and we had a headquarters on a farm in Voluntown, Connecticut. Mm. And we did all kinds of things, not only around New England, but down to New York and down to Washington and over to Saigon and Hanoi. And we helped to organize the San Francisco to Moscow Walk for Peace and the Quebec to Guantanamo Walk for Peace. That's a whole story in itself, but IRS decided that they wanted to go after us. And now all of the people that lived at the farm and did this work were paid their board and room and $1 personal allowance a week. And so obviously we didn't owe any taxes, but we did our work through donations, and those donations were made to the organization, but it was not a 501c3. So we got, they decided that four of us who were the main leaders and the longest term staff members owed taxes, and we were supposed to fill out some forms. I refused to fill out the form, so I was summoned to the IRS office in Norwich, Connecticut, to answer some questions. So we called in our committee members from around the region, and we had a nonviolence training course going on at the farm with a whole group of young people. So the night before the date, the young ladies and the young men made cookies and lemonade, and the next morning they went out in the fields and the garden and picked flowers, and they made signs and leaflets. And so a whole caravan of us went into the IRS office, and the committee members and staff members and I walked in the office, and the young people came in, and they put a bouquet on every desk, and they poured lemonade and handed out the cookies. Then they went outside and started to pick it. And this man who had been called in from Hartford to conduct this session said, "Well, Mrs. Swan, you come into this office with me. I want to ask you some questions." And I said, "Oh, no. My friends can hear what I have to say. We can do it out here." So he asked me these questions on this IRS form, and I never answered the question directly. I just gave a 4 or 5 sentence lecture on nonviolence or the Vietnam War or whatever was appropriate. And he finally sort of threw up his hands and said, "Well, I guess we can't do any more with that. Now why don't all of you come in the conference room and let's sit down and talk?" So we all trooped in there, and he proceeded to ask us some questions about the New England Committee for Nonviolent Action. One question he asked was, "Do you get your check from Moscow every month?" And we said, "Well, we're sorry, but we don't get any checks from Moscow." And if we did, I don't know what
wishful,
we didn't know what we
wishful
would do
thinking.
With them. And then at one point he said, "Well, now just how are you organized? What is this place called the New England Committee for Nonviolent Action?" And Brad Little spoke up and he said, Well, now, Mr. So-and-so, this was the gentleman from Hartford. You said a little while ago that that you're a Catholic. And he said, oh, yeah, I go to Mass every Sunday and every Wednesday night. And Brad said, well, now, in the Catholic Church, you have some institutions called monasteries and convents. Now, you know how they run. They sort of run on a cooperative, collective basis. You just think about the New England Committee for Nonviolent Action as being like those convents and monasteries, with one major exception, Brad said, and everybody broke out in a roar because they knew what the exception was, including the IRS men sitting there. So shortly after that, the gentleman said, well, I think this is all we need to do. You don't call us, we'll call you. And we never heard from them again.
Wow.
And so,
Emma?
They never, as far as I know, they have never bothered us.
S, most people think they can not do that, the withholding the tax.
Well, that's true.
Most people think they can't
do
it.
There have been some people imprisoned for it, not very many.
Or how? Or what? Could, should, whatever? They think they can't do that or whatever. But if you are willing to stand up for it. It seems like if your response in those times had been to, like, be fearful or to, like, back off, it would have gone a different way for you.
Well, I don't know for sure, and I'm always aware. I've always been aware that I could go to prison for it. And so I've always been prepared for that. But, and a few people have, there are a number of vortex resistance organizations, and there's a national sort of overall organization, and they have funds, and some people put the funds, the taxes they refuse, into those funds, which then are allocated in a public ceremony on April 15th every year to, you know, various good causes. And that is one way that some people deal with it. My husband and I stopped. We filed in 1949 with a strong protest. And for some reason, the IRS office lost our filing. And they wanted us to do it again. And we said, no, thank you. And we've never done it. He's dead now, but we never filed again. And as I said, we didn't just keep the money for ourselves.
Right, right,
we felt that we owed that to society, but we wanted it used in a more constructive form than killing people. And, so that's the vortex resistance. Congress passed the telephone tax again during the Vietnam War and had lapsed. So several hundred thousand people refused to pay that, and I still refuse to pay it. And that's not very much. It's a few cents at this point. But I just, it's against my conscience to pay a tax that was specifically levied to pay for military purposes. And I put a little note on my phone bill every month, and they duly refer it to IRS, but so far they haven't tried to collect. Probably I don't owe income taxes at this point because my income is so small and it's almost all Social Security. But I still refuse to file. And so I suppose I could be sent to jail sometime.
Isn't not F-I-L-I-N filing a C is not filing a crime? No, is not filing.
Yes.
Is not filing a C T U actual actually L E legal is not filing actually legal.
Yeah, no, it's illegal.
It's illegal to not follow file.
Now maybe I'm not sure whether it's illegal at this point with my low income. But it was illegal all those other years. Yes, you have to file a form whether you owe taxes or not. If you have sufficient income, which we did. Now there are, I know that there are some sort of right-wing groups who say that it's against the Constitution. The whole income tax is against the Constitution. I'm not a constitutional lawyer, so I don't know, but I doubt that that's correct. But they keep getting put in prison because they don't file or they don't pay. But it's not based on war resistance or military resistance for them. It's just part of not wanting, you know, not wanting to be controlled by the government.
What is L A N D land T R
land trust.
What is
land trust? Well, that's a concept where land is held in trust by an organization that's made up both representative of the people who are using the land and of the wider community. And it's based on two concepts. One was the Gandhian concept, which was particularly promoted by Vinoba Bhave in India after actually promoted, of course, by Gandhi too. And partly in India because so many people couldn't own land. They were in the lower classes. And partly based on Native American concept that you don't own land individually. Nobody owns land. They hold it in trust for future generations. So my husband and a man named Ralph Borsodi, who is an economist from New Hampshire, and along with some of the rest of us, formed what was called the Institute for Community Economics, and that was in the mid-60s. a group of people went to Israel to study their system there, where the land is owned by the Jewish National Trust, and very little land is owned individually in Israel. And they began to organize community land trusts, and the land that those trusts owned were used for low-income housing, cooperative housing, for worker-owned businesses. The women's and children's shelter that I that I was the director of put its land into a trust. During the 80s, there was a lot of farm foreclosures in the Midwest. And a young man named Chuck Mathai, who eventually became the director of the Institute for Community Economics, went out and organized a lot of the farmers, and they put their land into trust. They could stay on the land and they could farm it, but it couldn't be taken over by banks and and creditors, and so it saved a lot of farmland in Minnesota, Iowa, Illinois at that time. Chuck also went and started community land trusts in Kenya, and a lot of them down in Central America. In fact, one time. Chuck died not too long ago of cancer. He died very young, but somebody gave him $3 million to do land trusts and community development loan funds along the border between and in Central America. So that's a concept that that has grown in this country and around the world, and it helps people who can't afford to buy land to be able to use land for farms or housing or businesses and to have access to it. Incidentally, most community land trusts have always had very strong environmental rules about using, using fertilizer, insecticides and things. They tried to do that by natural means rather than.
Why? Why don't someone buy the H O U S houses in D E Detroit and L and P I P U put them in trust and
you mean some of the houses that are being foreclosed on
in
now?
Detroit is like,
I think that some land trusts are doing some of that. Of course, the money is so short for everybody. The community development loan funds and the community development credit unions have financed a lot of the community land trusts and the activities that go on, housing and so forth. I think it's very important to note that the default rate on those loans from community development loan funds is less than 1%. In other words, no bank, no other financial institution. And that's partly because of the technical assistance that goes along with the loans. It's like the Grameen loans that are given out, the Grameen bank loans that are given out, started in Bangladesh with Muhammad Yunus. They have a very high repayment rate because there's partly because there are groups of women, most of the Grameen loans go to women, who support each other and who see that they all repay their loans, partly because just because people feel morally obligated to pay those, and nobody is getting rich like the banks and the insurance company. They're out to make money, but nobody's out to make money in the community development loan funds and the Grameen Bank. That's not the purpose of them. So it's a totally different psychology that prevails there.
And have A R T artists M O move in to D Detroit. Oh, you're saying it. And then when they would buy these homes and with the trust or put them in trust, and then artists could move into the homes.
Yes, yeah. There is one now in Santa Cruz. I'm not sure if it's technically a community land trust, but it's a cooperative. They've taken some big old abandoned building and made artists combination apartments and studios for I think about 50 artists, but I don't know if it's a land trust arrangement or
and
it's reasonably priced.
When A R when artists M move in V A L value generally goes up. When the artists move into a neighborhood, the value of the neighborhood goes up generally.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. I didn't realize that. But I think that that's true in general of land that's owned by land trusts because it's cared for so well. And because the houses are often cooperatives that are built on that land, or the business is a cooperative. And that's a whole different mindset than when you use land or you build buildings to make profit. There's not a profit motive there, and therefore it becomes more valuable just because of its use.
Yeah. But E W I W I T with O without L A N land trusts what when the VA value goes up in a neighborhood, they M, they K, I, oh, they kick out the kind of the artists and the lower income people that were the source of the neighborhood's value going up.
Mm-hmm. Where was this?
Well, like, I think that's like the gentrification process you're thinking of, like in San Francisco, like in the Mission District, say,
yes.
And in New York.
Yeah, like the Lower East Side.
Yeah, yeah. You get all these creative people moving in, and the kind of consciousness or the kind of things get nicer, better. N, E, new, M, E, New Mexico. Frank lived in Santa Fe, and he saw that happen there.
Yeah.
And then all the people that were the ones that lived there before that happened, they started moving out of the city further and further because they couldn't afford to live in the city anymore.
Yeah. Well, that's not usually due to artists. That's usually due to commercial development, I think.
I think what Frank is saying is that the commercial development follows that. Like it's like a low income area.
Yeah.
That's the only place that the kind of creative community can afford to live in.
Mm-hmm.
So they're willing to go into these funky kind of funky neighborhoods.
Yeah.
Then and C R E A creative create L I life create life they create life in these funky neighborhoods and then it becomes appealing to people who think they can make a buck by going in there and developing it.
Well, that's why we need to grow more community land trusts and more sense of community. And I'm wondering if any of that is going to come out of our what's happening presently. I think I remember I was living during the Great Depression, and I remember that there was a lot, in a certain sense, a lot more sense of community because people were all so poor. We shared, I remember we shared food, you know. We had a pear tree and an apple tree in our yard, and somebody else had a plum tree and a lemon tree in their yard kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes catastrophe contributes. It also breaks down in many ways. I'm hoping and crossing my fingers that our new administration is going to make changes, but I think they've got to get control of the banks and the insurance companies and. They've got to put controls and regulations in because those people just walked off with the bank, you know.
Yes.
I didn't know if you wanted to know anything more about some of the other things that have happened to me or that I've done or. I don't know how long this session goes on, so.
We have time. What? How? See how the how was every day life. In the
at the farm at the New England Committee for Nonviolent Action or at the prison
all of the above And in D.C. and in D.C.
And the what?
And in Washington, D.C., what was everyday life like then?
Oh, well, in the war, it was very segregated. And so our core group did a lot of work to break down that segregation. We constantly went to government, only two, the cafeterias and only two government buildings were integrated. So a lot of the people in CORE were in the government, so they worked on the other cafeterias and the other buildings. We worked on drugstores. We worked on restaurants. We even had
How did you do that?
Well, you know, there was a process that CORE developed where, first of all, you investigated and got the facts down. Then you went and talked to the management and you tried to get them to change the policy. And if they wouldn't, you started picketing outside and leafleting and talking to the customers. And then if things didn't change, you started doing sit-ins in the restaurants. And there were a number of occasions, even in Chicago. I remember one where a number of us were sitting in the restaurant and the owner was, of course, threatening to call the police. And the other people who were dining there became so supportive of us that the owner finally just threw up his hands and told his waitress, okay, go ahead and serve them. And everybody in the restaurant started clapping. they didn't support the segregation.
Dukes. We would run into, not so much now, but years back when we would go to restaurants, because Frank eats with a bib and he ends up having food on the bib, that we would have people that wouldn't want us in their restaurants or would want. So the one in PRI in Princeton. I was C. I was R. E. Refused service for C. A. F. In four cafes in a row. Yeah,
in
that
Princeton.
Was like in the 70s. That was in the 70s.
Really? But now, with the Disabilities Act.
Yeah, now.
They don't dare.
No, nobody dare say anything. But in L.A., this was in I think, the early 90s.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was a popular restaurant, Duke's.
In Princeton.
And this is in L.A. now, in the early 90s in L.A.
In L.A.
And we went there, and Frank liked to sit at the front because they're like celebrities came there. It was just like an interesting place to people watch, and we'd like to sit there and watch everybody.
Yeah.
And the host was a gay man and an older man, so we knew he had lived during the period when it was not okay to be openly gay.
Yeah.
And at one point, it started kind of suck, because we went there every day while we were there for this like trip, and it would be like, well, wouldn't you rather sit in the back and have Frank face the wall so nobody could see him? He said, no, we'd rather sit in the front. We're kind of playing dumb, like we don't know what they're doing. But when the pressure came, was like more, and I don't remember if they like actually refused to sit us there, or at one point he said the owner came in or something, and I don't really remember how that went, like what the confrontation was, actually. They...
That reminds me.
For, they, M, A, made, us, sit in the back.
I remember once when I was living and working for a few months in Florida, in Jacksonville. And I worked in a restaurant out of Jacksonville Beach where all the kitchen help were black and all the customers and the management were white. And a friend of mine came to visit, and he was associated with some organization. And he was down there to consult with the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. So I said, let's go out to the restaurant where I've been working and get dinner. Well, the management just blew up.
Uh-huh.
He wasn't black, but the sleeping car porters were.
Oh, I see, yeah.
He was rather dark-skinned. He was a Jewish, and he had sort of swarthy skin. Oh, the manager blew up. He fired me. And I could see all the people from the kitchen peering through the partitions and out the door and doing this to me. So we went into town, and we went to a black restaurant. They sat us at the back of the restaurant, and I faced the wall. They fed us, but they didn't want to be seen serving an interracial group. They thought they might get into trouble.
I remember you told him, Frank told him, right, because they wanted us to sit in the back. We called like a lawyer group and found out legally what our rights were.
Mm-hmm.
And legally they couldn't do it.
Yeah,
they could not
right.
force us to
right.
sit in the back.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
We went back, and the N-E next day. Right. We went back the next day and told them that we would not sit in the back,
mm-hmm.
and that legally they couldn't make us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
you were served.
Well, they put us in the front, but they weren't happy, and the mm-hmm. owner showed up. Wasn't she there mm-hmm. next time we showed up?
Mm-hmm.
And Frank said to the host, the elderly gay man, he said, we won't sit in the back. He said it would be like telling a black person to sit in the back of the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow that made some impact on him, and he just like backed off and left us alone from that point.
As a gay man, he should have...
he should have related.
Known.
Yeah.
He should
yeah.
have empathized.
Yeah. W, before, I, S, A, I said that he should have put that together.
Mm-hmm.
You shouldn't have had to point it out to him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Speaking of gay people, I've had gay friends ever since I was 23 years old, so I've been through a lot of battles with people on that issue. But there was a member of our group in Washington. We had the core type group in Washington who was testing restaurants and so forth. Then we also had a peace group. and Stan was a member of both of them. He worked at the Library of Congress, and of course he never could come out there. He would have lost his job in a minute. But he was quite open with us. What was interesting to me was that there were black members, both of the core type group and the peace group. They accepted him. They didn't think anything of it. And he used to invite some of us gals to go out on dates occasionally, especially if there was something at the Library of Congress. Mm-hmm. And that was fine with us because he was a beautiful dancer and he was a wonderful guy. So, but we covered for him, you see.
Wow.
That was during the war in the 40s.
You were a F. A fag hag.
Yep, I guess so. And then Barbara Deming, who was a well-known writer and poet, was one of my closest friends. And, she was lesbian and had one partner, and then they separated, and she had another one until she died, but she never let that stop her from anything. And she was very active. She was in Birmingham with the when all of that was going on with the kids, and she was on all of our walks and things. And I don't think we thought very much about it. I mean, in our circles, it didn't matter whether you were gay or straight. It just didn't seem to make much difference. And I'm very agonized about this whole Prop 8 thing. It just seems so unfair. And, it's one area of discrimination that this country is not.
One in my platforms. When Frank was running for president, one of his platforms was to any group. Is that how you want to put it? Or any three people, any two or more people that have been together for, was it more than 2 years, should have all the legal rights of a married.
Yeah.
Have all the legal rights.
Yeah, like.
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 Could. Are register, they could register as
a family.
Mm-hmm. And the government should get out of the
Marriage
business.
Right. Leave that to the churches.
Yes, that's what he said. Leave the marriages to the churches, not the government.
Just get,
and any two or more people that were together could register as a family.
Yeah. When did you run for president?
In this last election, 08. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. I H G O. I got. O, F, F, I, official. Let's see. You mean the way we did with the electors and everything? Yeah, he did as a writing candidate, and I don't remember how many states off the top of my head, but it was, I think, like he had enough states that he was a registered writing candidate. That if he had Won in all of the states that he was a registered write-in candidate. He could have technically won the election. So he had enough states that he could have done that.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I didn't even know it, or I would have voted for it.
Carol was one of Frank's electors.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, we
she
needed 55 electors in California to...
She didn't tell me that.
Carol.
I'll have to
speak
tell
to her.
She didn't tell Mom. I have a friend who has run many times on as a candidate at the American Pacifist Party. He's one of the leaders of the nonviolent movement. He organized the San Francisco to Moscow Walk for Peace and the Quebec to Guantanamo Walk for Peace and the Polaris Action, out of which the New England Committee for Nonviolent Action was formed. And he decided he ought to be in the political sphere also.
It was amazing. It was. I mean, we didn't. I mean, it really didn't start out. It started out as a T-shirt for Frank. We had Mikey had a Three Stooges T-shirt, Curly for President, and it was like Frank had a birthday or something coming up, and we said, oh, we should make Frank a T-shirt, Frank Moore for President 08, just as like a gift. He started wearing the T-shirt, and people started saying, well, what's your platform? And Frank, being flexible, eventually sat down and typed up a platform because everybody kept asking him. So we'd have these typewritten sheets we'd give to people for F, R, for S, E, R, I, serious. Yeah, they were, it was serious. You know, he really wrote a very thoughtful platform. Mm-hmm. I could give her a copy of it. I have one here. And and what happened was that people started saying, well, I would vote for you. You know, and it was kind of like we started to feel like we had to like do something because people wanted to vote for Frank. So next thing you know, we're doing all this legal stuff to get him registered.
Wow.
They,
that's a lot of work.
Yeah, it was a, yeah. They, C, H, A, changed when they would read the platform. Yeah, that's what would happen is like we would say, here's the platform right here.
What
we
Carol
would say he's
has.
Running for president, and then they, well, I could read like the... This is the thing, and they'd start reading it, and they'd like kind of start looking up at Frank, like, "Oh, I'll do away with welfare and Social Security. Instead, every American will receive a minimum income of $1,000 a month. This amount will be tied to the cost of living and will not be taxable. We will have universal prenatal to the grave health care and universal free education with equal access. I'll do away with all tax deductions for over $12,000 income. Instead, there will be a flat tax of 10% on annual income of less than $1 million for an individual and less than $5 million for a corporation. But the flat tax will jump to 75% on annual income exceeding these limits. I'll cut the military budget by at least half. Public mass transit will be free, 24/7, and reliable. All patents and copyrights will expire in 20 years. Inventions, products, etc., which are developed with governmental money and or public institutions cannot be patented. All businesses selling their products in the U.S. will have to certify that their products were manufactured in accordance with this country's labor, wage, environmental, and safety laws, that they meet or exceed these no matter where they were produced. Each city and each media market will have at least two public access channels on radio, broadcast television, cable, and satellite. Election day will be a paid holiday. I will push for complete public funding for all political campaigns and the banning of political contributions and the use of personal wealth in political campaigns. The president should have a line veto, but the Congress can overturn this line veto by a simple majority. Also, bills should be limited to 5 pages in length and or limited to one subject. An individual taxpayer will be able to direct her taxes to what functions she wants to support. Mm-hmm. But corporate taxpayers should not have this option. Mm. Every corporation should come up for renewal every 25 years, at which time it must prove that it has been operating in the public interest. Mm. If it fails to do this, it loses its right to exist. Mm-hmm. Corporations that have existed before this policy will have 10 years before they will have to prove they are worthy. Uh-huh. Government should leave marriage to churches. Instead, any 2 or more adults who have been living together for at least 2 years should be able to register as a, quote, family. The end of hunger, poverty, and discrimination in this nation will be my main focus domestically. This will also shape my foreign policy. The minimum income and the minimum/livable wage linked to the cost of living will rise every time the Congress members vote themselves a pay raise, will rise by the same percentage of their raise. Yeah, education should be federally funded based on the number of students, adjusted to special needs of each student in each school district, but schools should be locally controlled. The equal access of education for every student will be ensured by the federal government. I will call for a major rebuilding of America. We will repair our school buildings and will build needed new schools. I will encourage a society of small villages connected by mass transit. Within these small villages, people could walk or bike to work, to school, to shopping, to entertainment, etc. Mass transit will combine these small villages within 15 miles radius into dynamic communities. Living in these villages will end gridlock traffic, will cut greenhouse gases, will cut stress and isolation. Housing for all incomes will be included equally in each village. Mm-hmm. We will encourage electric cars, fast trains, clean, sustainable, decentralized energy generators. I would shut down all nuclear generators.
Yay.
I will destroy 10% of our nuclear weapons each year to reverse the nuclear arms race. We will stop giving, selling arms to other countries. All private arms sales should be illegal. Now, my policies are pro-business. The universal education system will provide business with a superior, flexible workforce. The minimum income and the universal health care will remove the business's burden of providing health insurance and pensions to workers. In reality, this relief will be much more than any tax cut could give. Moreover, the minimum income will make the starting and maintaining a small business much easier. This is also true for small family farms. The minimum income will encourage independent invention and artistic pursuit on which true progress depends. The primary function of the government should be the protection of the health, the civil and human rights, the freedoms, and the general welfare of the people, instead of the protection and the promotion of corporate profits and interests. The government should exist to serve the people and not to make a profit on the services of the people. My administration will be governed by these basic principles. I will bring the troops home from Iraq immediately. Moreover, I will change this country's self-image from that of the superpower/world leader to that of a member of the global community. Prisons should be only for violent or otherwise dangerous criminals. Prisons should be a part of the health and educational system and should include drug rehab programs. This should also be true for the new creative in-community programs for nonviolent criminals for paying back, rehab, and education sentencing. These programs will be more effective and much less expensive and harmful to the community on every level than the current human warehouse system. Flexibility of sentencing should be returned to judges. I will ban the death penalty. The use of drugs should be legalized and taxed. Pot and spirit should be sold over-the-counter to adults only. Tobacco and other addictive drugs should be sold by prescription only. Free drug rehab programs should be readily available. All of the opt-out schemes should be illegal. If a corporation wants to sell your information, it first should directly and clearly get your permission. Before this happens, all such information is part of your privacy, not the property of a corporation. The selling, buying of debt should be illegal. Moreover, there should be a maximum interest rate of 10% on the original principal over the lifetime of a loan. I will forgive the loans to the so-called third world countries over the original principal. We will use half of the money we will save by cutting the military budget to pay down the national debt. I will reduce the pollution caused by obscene corporate profits. I will also reduce the federal government while raising services to the people by getting rid of welfare, Social Security, the so-called war on drugs, etc., and by the cuts in the military, the IRS, prisons, etc. This platform of mine gives you an outline of what we will do together, of what I see this country and the world becoming. It is definitely possible if we are willing. Yep, it is radical, but it just makes sense, doesn't it? Was the just makes
great.
Sense part.
Can I have it?
Yeah.
Why don't you run for governor? Start in California.
P. E. People have asked me that. Yeah.
That's good. Well, I think Obama borrowed a few of your ideas.
He borrowed a few of Frank's ideas.
Yeah.
But he should borrow more.
Yes, absolutely. I have great admiration for him, but I'm very worried about sending more troops to Afghanistan and pulling the troops out of Iraq so slowly. And
yes.
I certainly support Barney Frank's idea of cutting the military budget now 25%. And I think we ought to do a big campaign on that because, as I said, Barham said in his own book that Bush raised it 74%. Mm-hmm. That is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. That is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. It was already way too high. I keep writing that. When Obama was running, I wrote it to whatever their email was, and then I wrote it to the transition committee because they kept asking us for ideas. And now I'm about to write a postal letter to Mr. Obama because I don't think anybody reads all the email he gets. Somebody might read the postal mail.
Right. Yeah.
But I don't know unless we can get a big enough campaign started to cut the military budget. But I think Barney Frank leading it might develop. You know, it'll catch on.
In C H I Chicago. Did you H G O go to J A jazz clubs when you were in Chicago? When you were in Chicago, did you ever go to jazz clubs?
Not very much. My first boyfriend, whom I didn't get until I was a senior because I was so young, and I graduated from high school when I was 16. So I was younger than everybody else, but he and his brother had a band. So I often went to their gigs, and sometimes he would put down his saxophone and dance with me. And I do remember hearing Edith Piaf one time at a big, a fancy club in Chicago. That's not exactly jazz, but I have a whole, I knew, I'm sorry, I forgot his name now. He's quite a famous singer from Chicago. It'll come back. I did have a whole collection of bootlegged New Orleans jazz records. I'm afraid they're lost someplace. Uh-huh. And, they were all the old time jazz from New Orleans.
Oh my.
I don't know. I can't remember how I even got them, but, you know, I had about 20 of them.
Wowee. And,
of course, I was brought up in the era of swing music and jazz. I'm not sure how I feel about some of the more contemporary music. It doesn't attract me as much as jazz and some of the old ones.
What did you think of the L.I. Living Theater? What did you think of the Living Theater?
Oh, well, I was, of course, very interested in them because my daughter was part of it, one of my daughters. She went to Howard University after high school, and partly because Owen Dotson was the dean of the arts department, and she was in a lot of plays there, and I saw her several times. And then when she left there and moved to New York, she joined the Living Theater, and I think I saw a couple of the plays she was in there. But we knew Judith and what was her husband's name? I've forgotten.
Julian Beck.
Yeah, Julian Beck.
Yes.
But they were part of the broader peace movement, of course. And so were the puppeteers from Vermont.
Yes.
Barbara Deming was part of the writers group that were part of the peace movement. So it was, in those days, was in the 60s, there were Norman Mailer, was a great writer that was part of the peace movement, and so many others. And I'm not sure whether there's that that togetherness now. What do you think, Frank?
No, you don't think that there is. Not that you're aware of. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're saying? Mm-hmm. Yeah. In some hip hop. In some hip hop?
Mm-hmm. Some. I'm not sure though that they're too always too socially conscious. There are some people,
you?
Of course, Bono and Sean Penn and, some of the big actors are very involved. I just saw Milk the other day.
Uh-huh.
I was thrilled all over that he won the Oscar. Because he does a lot of good stuff around the world. I thought that was a beautiful picture. I mean, I just sat there and bawled.
Wow, we haven't seen it yet.
You haven't? No. Oh, go see it. It's, Yeah.
We will see it. Yeah. We will see
it. Yeah, do go to see it. It's one of the best pictures, just as a movie, that I've seen in a long time. It's very well done. I don't see very many, but...
When I... S.A. sat in at the federal building in San Francisco in the 70s to M. Milk came through to, you know, say hello to people.
What were you sitting in for?
It was for disability rights. A M O N T. It was a month long sit in.
There were some in the East too. One of my we did some cooperative housing in a land trust in Willimantic, Connecticut. We did it primarily for Hispanic families because they were large and they had such terrible housing. But a couple or three of us were not Hispanic that lived there, and one was a woman with disability, and she did a lot of work, you know, in that area. And she, I don't know if she's still living because she moved to Denver, and I haven't heard from her for a long time. But she did a lot of organizing.
You going to wrap it up now? Yeah? Okay.
Okay.
So, yeah. Wow. Who, tell everybody what your name is.
my name is Marjorie Swan Edwin, and my husband was Bob Swan, who was in prison during World War II and who was involved in all of this with me. And he's dead, but my husband now is from Ghana, West Africa, and he is senior bishop of a Methodist denomination with churches in five countries in Africa. And they formed their own denomination back in 1987 because churches, so many church people in Africa and the islands were treated, even by black churches in this country, and I'm both a Quaker and AME myself, but they were treated like colonial subjects by the churches in this country. And so they decided, not just Methodists, but a whole group of them in 87, to form a new church. And, you know, they have several differences. They have women ministers and women bishops. They incorporate some African customs that are not in conflict with Christianity into their services and activities. And they have a church governance that's much broader. In the Methodist churches here, the ministers and the bishops are... they have the say, you know, for the most part, and they give the orders. That was not true at the AME church where we were married and that I belonged to in Connecticut. That minister had a business meeting every month, and, you know, we would turn out 80 strong to discuss the business of the church. But he was very unusual, and so... when my husband and all these other people from several countries organized the new church in 87, that's what they incorporated. However, in some ways they are extremely conservative. Mm. And I tell my husband that when the colonials moved in and the missionaries went with them, the missionaries took some of the worst aspects of Christianity, like approval of slavery. Mm. And my husband and I have very strong disagreement about the issues around gay issues, for instance.
Oh, wow.
And so we had to agree to disagree on some things.
Wow.
But you know, there's always hope, I guess.
Okay. A. Yes. A. A. May. Maybe. You. Can. S. H. Show. Him. The. L. I. Living. No, L-I-V. L-I. G. H. Show him the light. Maybe you can show him the light.
Well, I have tried. Do you know Bishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa? This last April in San Francisco, he was given an award by the International Gay and Lesbian Rights Human Rights Association, and he made the most beautiful speech in response, and in which he said, among other things, that when he was Archbishop in South Africa, two of his ministers were gay, and he knew that. And they have now moved up the hierarchy. So in the Episcopal Church in South Africa, they have two, I guess they're bishops by now, who are gay. And I did send my husband that speech. He was not very happy with me. But I sent it to him because he so admires Bishop Tutu. Mm-hmm. And I have always compared them because Bishop Tutu, of course, struggled against apartheid and brutality in South Africa. And my husband was a bishop struggling against a dictatorship of the Rawlings in Ghana, which was very brutal for years at the same time. Mm-hmm. So I felt like they were parallel.
Right.
But on the issue of gays and lesbians, they are totally different.
Wow.
And, you know, it's hard to accept that for me because of my long association. And but that's one of the...
How long have you been married?
Almost 15 years.
Oh, wow. Yeah. G. Oh, good. L. Good luck.
Thank you. Thank you. Same to you. Thank you for having me. This has been a very enjoyable conversation.
Yeah, for us too. Yeah.
Invite me back some other time and I'll tell you some more of my adventures. We haven't begun to cover them all.
Yes. I will.
Okay.
I will.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Good night, everybody. Mm-hmm.